Thanks. Thanks for inviting me here and letting me talk about my research. So today I want to talk about field theory duopolies and their relevance in condensed matter physics. So very roughly, I'll define it more precisely later, but very roughly, I want to talk about a scenario in which two seemingly very different quantum field theories are secretly the same. Right? That's basically the idea. By different, I mean the two theories are typically formulated in terms of very different degrees of freedom. There are many familiar examples in 1+1 dimension. The bosonization, for example, is one example. Or we can do the Jordan-Wigner duality relating a free Majorana fermion to the 1+1D transverse field Ising model. Right? And the nice thing about that is usually we gain different insights from different pictures. Some problems that's incredibly hard in one picture becomes occasionally becomes quite easy in the other. And in today's talk, I'm going to mainly focus on some version of this such dualities, but in 2+1 dimensions. Okay? And those dualities are interesting, you know, on their own, but they also turn out to be incredibly useful for many seemingly very different problems in modern condensed matter physics. So you can have a lot of fun with it. So in the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen developments on this frontier in several different directions. So there's for us, we began the journey by thinking about U1 spin liquids, a class of exotic magnets in 3 dimensions. And there we inevitably end up thinking about electromagnetic dualities of 3+1 dimensional U1 gauge theories. And that actually turns out to be related to certain field theory dualities in 2+1 dimensions. It's also related to the story of topological insulators. More specifically, what happens if on the surface of a topological insulator, which is usually gapless, I turn on a strong interaction. The question is, can I gap it out without breaking any symmetries? That turns out to be also related to the story. More surprisingly, first realized by Damson, that you can also use this set of duality ideas to tackle the classic half-field Landau level problem and actually resolve some 2-decade-old issue known as the particle hole symmetry. More recently, we've been using the idea of dualities to think about exotic quantum phase transitions. There's certain problems that that we've managed to resolve. This is going to be actually, I'll talk about this in more detail later. Okay. So this is the outline of the rest of my talk. So I'll first give you an introduction. So to tell you exactly what I mean by duality. And give you the simplest example in 2+1 dimension, known as the boson vortex duality. And then I'll talk about an extension of this boson vortex duality to an entire web of dualities we developed in the past 2 years. As I said, there are many examples of applications of this duality ideas in condensed matter problem. I'll more specifically talk about the application in the context of what's known as the deconfined quantum criticality and quantum electrodynamics in 2+1 dimension. Okay. So let me first define exactly what I mean by duality. So I have two quantum field theories, let's say. So when I define the field theory, I want to define it in the UV. You may want to define in the high energy way, meaning I start with a Gaussian fixed point, turn on relevant perturbation, or you can try to define on the lattice. Either way. So they don't have to be the same in the UV. Right? But the statement is if...
It doesn't have to be a Gaussian fixed point.
It's if you want to define the old-fashioned way, you want a Gaussian plus relevant perturbation. So you start from Gaussian, but then you flow to something else.
But you could do.
In principle, there are theories. The 2, 0, you cannot do it. But yeah. In this talk, I'll be focusing on those, mainly those kind of theories. So they may not be the same in the UV, but the statement is if I do the RG flow and go all the way to the deep IR, they're actually the same fixed point. Okay. So let me give you the simplest example in 2 plus 1. There are even simpler examples in 1 plus 1, but let me do this one. So it's known as the boson vortex duality. And to have some intuition on this, let me do it on the lattice. Okay. So suppose I have some hardcore bosons hopping on a, let's say, square lattice. Okay. It's a classic problem in condensed matter physics. So there are two simple conventional quantum states. So the first one is a superfluid, where essentially the bosons just move around quite freely. Okay? And you have superflow, Bose condensate, all that. So the other state, which is called a Martensleider, is also a very simple state. This happens when you have one boson per site, and the repulsion between the bosons are so strong that they basically, you know, get stick on the sides. They don't really move. So that's an insulator. Those are the two phases here. And so you can describe them in terms of particles. This is the particle picture. It turns out you can also describe them in terms of what's known as vortices. Right? So suppose I have a superfluid, then I can think about the phase of this of my boson field, essentially. And in the superfluid phase, the phase vector basically aligns almost perfectly well. So if I view this as a vector, then there's no vorticity in this variable. Right? So in terms of vortex, I can think of it as a vacuum of vortex, or an insulator of vortex. So what about the Martensleider? Well, here, if I think in terms of phases, the phases are random. They fluctuate quite arbitrarily. And in terms of vortices, this state has a lot of vortices. And it's in fact a condensate, both condensate of vortices. Right? So basically, I can map a particle superfluid to a vortex insulator and a particle insulator to a boson, to a vortex superfluid. So that's the duality in the simplest incarnation. Well, things get a little bit more interesting if I think about the phase transition between the two phases. Okay? So if I think in the particle picture, so what what's the theory of the phase transition? Well, it's just really an O2 Wilson-Fisher theory. It's an O2, so this phi is a complex scalar in the continuum. And so it's the standard phi-4 theory, except that for the quadratic term, the phi square, I tune it to the critical value. And this is the standard interaction term. And this capital B is, you can view it as a probe gauge view. It's a background U1 gauge view that couples to the conserved charge. Okay? It's a number. So that's in the particle picture. Well, for the vortex picture, so you know, I'm in the particle picture, I'm thinking about a superfluid to insulator transition. That means in the vortex picture, I should be thinking about an insulator to superfluid transition. Well, the natural guess is that this is again an O2 Wilson-Fisher for the vortices. So this phi hat. Denotes the vortex field. But we know vortices are not quite local. They interact through a logarithmic long-range potential. And that's captured by this by coupling this phi hat to a dynamical gauge field, little b. So this is a U1 gauge field that's now fluctuating. So if I do path integral, I should integrate little b over. Okay? Yeah, in general, there's always a Maxwell term. Yeah, so this is a shorthand notation. Now, the left-hand side, capital B is a number. It's not dynamical. But here it's important you have a F square. Yeah. And this final term, sometimes called BF term or mutual Chen-Simon term, it's a mutual coupling between the little b and capital B. It's really denoting the physics that this phi hat is a vortex. For example, if I have a magnetic flux of capital B, this term will force me to have a finite density of this phi hat. And so on. Okay.
Sure. Yeah. So on the left hand side, you said B represents a background, constant background.
Yeah.
What does it actually represent in practice?
No, I probe. You know, this is like a probe field, right? In practice, for example, I can try to turn on a small flux on my lattice, or I can just turn on the electric field, right? Either way. So this is a, sorry, this is a vector potential. It's not.
So it's external?
Yeah, it's external.
And you use it to probe the theory.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right, so the postulate is that the two theories defined this way actually correspond to the same fixed point. Right? Because one theory is the transition in the vortex particle picture, the other is in the vortex picture. And really, there's no analytic proof of this strong postulate, actually. Both theories are actually strongly coupled in the IR. So analytically, there isn't much to do. But numerically, people have been checking this statement quite extensively, and looks like it's consistent. But analytically, we can perform some consistency check, make sure that at least it's a logically consistent possibility. Yes?
One small question. I'm a little bit confused to what you mean by duality here. So you mean that you can map one theory to the other at every energy scale, or is
no,
it?
No, it's an IR.
So then what's the difference between saying that they're just in the same equivalence class?
It is.
The duality.
They are in the same universality class.
Okay.
Yeah. It is. If you like, it's a broader sense of universality class.
Okay.
Right. So the typical consistency checks people can make is that to realize they have the same set of local operators and the same set of phase diagram if I perturb these theories away from their fixed points. For this particular case, one can also quote unquote derive this duality on the lattice, but the price you pay is the version you are deriving is a strongly coupled version. It's not the typical Gaussian fixed point plus relevant perturbation kind of continuum field theory. But if you assume the two are equivalent, then that's a derivation.
I have another question. Yeah. So when you say the same local operators, if we were talking about even simpler scenario, we have the Ising model, critical Ising model in 1 plus 1, and we have three fermions in 1 plus 1, would you call those two?
It's a little bit tricky there. In this context, when I say local, I mean gauging variant, right? So they, for example, phi hat is not a local operator on the right-hand side. And if I do the Jordan-Wigner mapping, if I start from the Ising model, then on the Majorana fermion side, I shouldn't call my Majorana fermion a local operator, basically. Only the bilinears or the instanton operator.
But if you just come to the quadratic operators, then local operators on one theory are local operators.
I mean, of course, we know that in that case, on the fermion side, it's the instanton that maps to the Ising scalar. Right, so let me show you how the consistency checks works. I won't go mention much about the lattice derivation because it's not going to be used for the other dualities I talk about. So let's first make sure that the two theories actually have the same global symmetry. Well, there's the obvious U1 charge conservation on the left-hand side. So it corresponds to a conserved current of this phi boson. So on the right-hand side, actually, first of all, that doesn't correspond to the conservation of the phi hat charge because that's gauged. It doesn't count. But there is a conserved current on the right-hand side. That is the electric magnetic flux of this emergent gauge field, little b. Okay? And the conservation of this object follows from the Bianchi identity of the U1 gauge theory. Okay? So charge here corresponds to magnetic flux here. And what about the local operators? Well, the simplest local operator is this phi boson on the left-hand side. So this is a bosonic field that carries charge 1. So I want, on the right-hand side, a local operator, a gauging variant 1, that carries charge 1. But charge is flux here. So I want an operator that carries flux 2 pi. And by definition, that's an instanton operator for my U1 gauge field, or a multiple operator, if you like. I call it M. So that's the charge operator. What about the other operator? Well, there is an important operator phi squared term here. This is the term I tune across my transition. Right? The claim is that it maps again to the boson mass phi hat square term here, but with the opposite sign of the mass. For that, you just check the phase diagram. Right? Imagine turning this on and see what happens. Okay? So for this sign of mass, if it's negative, So on the left-hand side, what you get is a condensate of phi. So you get a superfluid. And if you go to low energy, the only thing you have is the Goldstone mode. Right? Well, on the right-hand side, because the sign is inverted, the phi hat is gapped. Right? So you just throw it away at low energy. And then at low energy, you get a free Maxwell photon for this little b. Okay? And you know, on both sides, you have exactly a single free boson here. It's Goldstone versus free photon. They're the same in 2 plus 1. But if you imagine the opposite sign of the mass, let's say it's positive, then on the left-hand side, this phi is gapped. So at low energy, you literally have nothing. Yeah.
What about the discrete symmetries? Like in the right-hand side, you're breaking time reversal.
No, this one doesn't break time reversal. Time reversal is fine.
Even if you plug in a magnetic field?
Oh, if you plug in magnetic field, you break time reversal on both. Sure.
Okay. So,
yeah. So, right, so on the left-hand side, you get a vacuum. On the right-hand side, you get a condensate of this phi hat boson because the sign is inverted. But that also gaps out everything because the Higgs mechanism will ensure that the gauge field, little b, is also gapped. So also you get a trivial vacuum. Okay? So this is what I mean by matching the phase diagram. Okay? Of course, then the postulate is that even at the critical point, they're the same. So now let me, yeah.
This argument basically shows that there are like two equivalent physical degrees of freedom which look same on the low energy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think we need to check how they are interacting should look the same and how to do
that. Yeah, that's why proving this duality is hard. If I stay away from the critical point, then you know this duality is nothing more than what I say here. Okay, because at low energy, that's you know, have a free boson, you have a trivial vacuum. What can you do? But here, you actually have to think. For example, you can ask, does the scaling dimension of this phi match the scaling dimension of this funny instanton operator here? How do you calculate that? Analytically, there isn't much you can do. You can do epsilon expansion, but you won't trust that anyway because epsilon equals one. So analytically. This is as much as you can do. You just make sure that you're not saying anything crazy. But in principle, you can still be wrong. Yeah, and what practically for this duality, people could do Monte Carlo simulation, quite serious ones, for this theory. And the exponent they saw roughly is what you get from XY model.
So now that you mentioned the epsilon expansion, so you expect this duality to work only in 2 plus 1. It doesn't work for...
Oh, it's known that it's not. It doesn't work in 3 plus 1. In 3 plus 1, this is a first order transition.
Okay.
So, yeah. That's why epsilon expansion doesn't work on this one. Yeah. At least in one loop. All right. That story was figured out in the late 70s, early 80s, probably in slightly different language.
Is there a real argument for the sign? Apart from the fact that you want the previous picture,
that's really the argument. Yeah,
it's not derived. It's just
so you don't. Okay, let me qualify this. So in the continuum, that's all you can do. If you put it on the lattice, then you can sort of map the partition function, and then you can really see that roughly they should have the opposite sign. All right, so. So now let me extend that to more dualities, some more recent story. This work. So for this part, I'll be talking. You can find what I'll be talking about in this paper. It's done with Nadi Seiberg, Sento, and Ed Witten. Kar Kantong had a paper that posted on the same day with us largely overlapping results. All right, so. So let me talk about another duality. So now this one involves fermion. Okay? So on the left-hand side, I have a free Dirac fermion. It's actually much simpler than the Wilson-Fisher boson. We know almost everything about it. So it's a free two-component Dirac fermion, a single one, in 2 plus 1 dimension. And again, this capital A is a background gauge field. So in this talk, whenever I have capital A, capital B, they're background, little a, little b, they're dynamical. So this extra transignment term with coefficient 1 over 8 pi comes from the need to regularize this Dirac fermion. This is known as the parity anomaly. In condensed matter term, this is just saying that if I try to realize a single Dirac fermion on a lattice in strict two dimension, then necessarily I have a background Hall conductance half integer. Okay? So this is the theory. So on the right-hand side, it looks very similar to what I had before. So it's, again, a Wilson-Fisher boson tuned to criticality that couples to this dynamical gauge field little b. There's also this BF coupling, except I have an extra Chen Simon term for this little b at level 1. Okay? That's the only difference. Okay. So there are some very basic consistency check you can make. For example, the U1 conservation of the fermion charge here, again, correspond to the U1 conservation of the magnetic flux of this little b on the right-hand side. Turns out the local operator also match. So on the left-hand side, the simplest operator is probably the free fermion psi. And on the right-hand side, again, I want an operator, a local operator that carries charge 1. So again, I want an instanton operator, so this mb. But it turns out this Chen Simon term does two things, two non-trivial things on the instanton operator. First, you need to stick a phi boson onto it to make a gauge invariant, although otherwise it carries gauge charge. Second, probably more importantly, that it converts this instanton to a fermion. It attaches essentially a spin half to this instanton object. Okay? So this is a fermion, this is obviously a fermion, so that local operator match. So I'll talk about more consistency check later.
There is no phi squared term on the right side.
The phi squared, okay. So phi squared term is always there. You tune it to the critical value.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. This is a shorthand notation for that. Right. So if you are familiar with the quantum Hall literature, this is really the gapless version of what's known as the flux attachment or composite boson that's worked out in the 80s, 90s. Right. But here, the non-trivial thing is essentially you assume the statement is this works all the way to the gapless point. Okay. And again, this can be morally derived on the lattice, if you believe in the strongly coupled theory is equivalent to this weakly coupled theories, or a couple wires. It's done in this papers. It's also related to what's known as the mirror dualities in supersymmetric quantum field theories. It's actually probably the simplest version of mirror duality in 2 plus 1. Okay. Well, let me now show you more consistency checks. There are two of them. The first one is, let's match the phase diagram again. The statement is, if I have a mass term for my Dirac fermion on the left-hand side, I claim that it's equivalent to a mass term for the Wilson-Fisher boson. Okay. So how do I check that? Well, so again, I look at what's going on at low energy. So once I have a mass term, my Dirac fermions are gapped, so I can integrate it out. So integrating out this massive Dirac fermion, we know that it gives me a Chen Simon term response at level plus minus half, depending on the sign of the mass. Okay? So if the sign is negative, I get minus 1 over a pi minus 1 over a pi, so I get minus 1 over 4 pi. So that's a Hall conductance at minus 1. Yeah. That's an integer quantum Hall state. And with the opposite sign, this response term cancels with the background term, so I get nothing. So it's really what I'm describing is a transition between an integer quantum Hall state or a chain insulator to a trivial insulator in the free fermion picture. I'm just doing band theory, actually. What about the right-hand side, this bosonic theory? Well, with one sign, my phi boson condenses. And I get once it condenses, I don't care about the Chen Simon term or any of that. The gauge field is Higgs. So there's nothing in the IR. So it's a trivial Higgs phase, a trivial insulator. Well, with the other sign, I get a massive phi boson. So again, I integrate out. Then I'm left only with a pure gauge theory. This Chen Simon theory at level 1 that couples this way. And this is a quadratic gap theory, so I can just integrate out little b. Integrating out is really a fancy word for solving the equation, classical equation of motion, and put it back in. And then I get a Hall this response term, which is what you get from a free fermion. So really, I'm describing a transition between integer quantum Hall effect and a trivial insulator in two languages. So the left-hand side is a free fermion language. So on the right-hand side is really the composite boson language. And the postulate is that it doesn't matter which language I'm describing the transition, I get the same transition. Yeah.
You're in all these examples, you are just considering a one family. You consider one parameter.
Yeyeah.
There was one relevant perturbation.
Here naturally, you probably only expect one relevant perturbation, as long as you preserve the symmetry. Of course, okay, if you preserve the U1 conservation, think on this side, this is the only relevant perturbation you can have. On this side, at least at tree level, this looks like the only relevant perturbation you have. But if you break U1, there are more stuff there. This one can have pairing, this one can have instanton term.
And the claim about this duality is only within the framework of preserving the symmetry?
No. You can break the symmetry, and then the claim is they should have the same effect. It should have the same effect on both sides. Yeah. All right. So that's actually, those marks are actually quite simple. People could have figured out, and probably did figure out, those in the 90s. There were a couple reasons why this wasn't taken very seriously in the 90s. One of the reasons is that time reversal doesn't seem to work out in this case. Right? If I want to claim two theories are the same theory, at least I better have the same symmetry on both sides. But it doesn't look like the case for this theory. So for this, let me add this 1 over a pi ADA term on both sides. So to make it this form. Physically, what I'm doing is to put the theory, both theories, on the surface of a topological insulator. Right? And that makes the left-hand side, this free Dirac fermion, manifestly time reversal invariant. It's what you get on the surface of a TI. But then you have trouble with the right-hand side. So you have this Chen-Simon term, BDB, you have this...
If you have a background A, that breaks time.
Oh, sorry. I have to transform A in a certain way. Yeah. If I invert my magnetic field. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. But if I have these two terms, it's very easy to see that if I perform an anti-unitary time reversal symmetry on this theory, the coefficient has to change sign. There's nothing to negotiate about that. Then you have trouble. Is it not time reversal invariant? If so, then it can't possibly be due to this guy. It turns out that the way out is to realize that, yeah, it's true that these two terms flip sign under time reversal. But then you can perform a further duality on the phi boson. Basically, the particle vortex duality I mentioned before. And then after a few lines of algebra, you realize you actually get back the same Lagrangian, essentially. So what that means is that time reversal symmetry doesn't transform in a non-local fashion on the phi boson. It takes phi to its vortices. That's OK, because phi is not a local object to begin with. It's not gauge invariant. So if it transforms in a non-local fashion, that let it be. So that's how you resolve it. To me, it's a quite non-trivial check that this time reversal could possibly work out on this theory and gives us more confidence on the correctness of this duality. Okay. Turns out if you assume the correctness of this duality, you can derive more or less with some assumption. Infinitely more dualities. So the logic is roughly this. You start from a duality, let's say Lagrangian A1 is dual to Lagrangian 2. Both have a conserved U1 charge, so we call it coupled to a background capital A. So there are two operations you can perform on this theories. So the first operation is called S. So it's I take my theory 1, and I promote my probe gauge field to a dynamical one. Just replace capital A by little a, but still demand that the flux of little a is conserved. So I can still couple it to another probe gauge field capital A. So this capital A has nothing to do with this capital A. Okay? So this is the operation S. So in general, if I do this, these two theories are completely different. Okay? Except for very special scenarios. Otherwise, these two are different theories. But suppose I do it on both sides, since these two are supposed to be dual. If I do it on both sides, I generate another duality for two different theories. Okay. So that's a non-trivial operation. Well, there's a much simpler operation called T. I still keep this capital A as a background field, but now I added response term, a background term, a Chern-Simon term at level one on both sides. Okay. And of course, trivially, these two should also be dual, since these two are dual. Okay. Physically, what I'm doing is to stack a layer of integer quantum Hall on top of both sides. Well, this seemed to be a quite trivial operation, but the funny thing is the two operations do not commute. You can keep doing ST, and then you generate infinitely many dualities. And in fact, the reason that they are called S and T is because this set of operations generates an SL2Z, a modular transformation on this, a modular group on these theories. Okay? So essentially, there are infinitely many theories, dualities there. And,
A is a background field.
Yeah, capital.
You're adding a constant to the Lagrangian.
So this is a background term, meaning it doesn't change the dynamics, but it changes the response. So it's like adding a layer of integer quantum Hall. So dynamically, it doesn't do anything because it's gapped. But if I turn on a perturbation in capital, let's say I turn on an electric field, and I measure the current, it's going to be different. This gives me an extra Hall conductance. One.
Is that because you're coupling a source to it? Or what are you doing? I mean, it should just be a phase.
Well,
it's a constant in the action. It should have no effect at all.
No. The definition of current is I take the functional derivative of this guy with respect to capital A. Right? That's the current. And if I add this term...
It's not clear to me why that's the right definition of current if A is just a constant.
Well, no. If A is constant, this is just a constant. But the thing is, I want to probe my physics by changing A and look at the response. Yeah, I mean this is the response theory of an integer quantum Hall. So if I have an integer quantum Hall and I go to low energy, integrate out the gap degree of freedom, this is what I get. Yeah. But I agree, dynamically, if I measure correlation function and so on, nothing changes. That's absolutely true. It's more or less. So it's more interesting when this is combined with the other operations. Yeah.
And also, you keep A classic.
Yeah. Capital A is always a number. Little a is what I integrate over. All right. So let me. I'll be talking about mainly another example, but let me first just mention this example for fun, because it looks nice. So this is what we call a fermionic particle vortex duality. It looks a lot like the bosonic particle vortex duality I mentioned before. So on one side, I have a free Dirac fermion, but on the right hand, on the other side, I have a Dirac fermion, a single Dirac fermion, now coupled to a dynamical gauge field little a, and this little a again coupled to the external a in this way. Right? So it almost looks identical to the boson vortex one if you replace the Wilson-Fisher action by the Dirac term. And this duality, it turns out, is related to several different things. It turns out to be very useful for understanding the Hopfield lambda level problem, especially the particle Hall symmetry issue, which has been there probably since 97 something. But I won't go into too much detail of that because I don't have time. It turns out it's also related to the story of the strongly interacting surface states of topological insulators. There's a very weird topological order called T-Fafian that for quite some time we didn't understand how to think in terms of Dirac fermions. But once you have this duality, it's a one-liner argument for that. And it's also related to electric magnetic dualities, a special kind of electric magnetic dualities in 3+1 dimension. Okay. But I won't go into the detail of any of that. Instead, let me talk about a more recent work I did with Adam Nahum, Max Malitsky, Chen Keshi, and Sento here. It's about the deconfined criticality and quantum electrodynamics. Actually, before I go that, it's probably a good place to pause. Is there any question on the previous part?
At some point you mentioned that if you don't have the same symmetries on the two Lagrangians, then there's kind of no hope of finding a duality. But can it be the case that you, one of those theories have that symmetry as an emergent symmetry?
That's what I will be talking about in this part.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Promise. So that could happen. So the reason I, you know, for this part, it's more like, you know, if you assume the duality, then you can say, okay, time reversal will emerge at low energy. But if you still, if you haven't been converted into a believer of this duality, then I have to convince you with as many, you know, evidence as I can find. And this is one of the non-trivial evidence. Yeah. But I will do the other thing the next part. Yes.
So you restore time reversal invariance by doing this duality on the right.
Yeah.
So on the left side, you said that you change time and then change the magnetic field direction.
Yeah.
On the right side, it amounts to changing vertex to anti-vertex. Is that the?
No, it's more than that, because this phi is a vortex charge bound state. So just changing vortex to anti-vortex is not enough. You actually have to somehow flip this phi to its vortex. Yeah. That's why it's non-trivial. Because it's charge and vortex, they transform differently under time reversal. One flips, the other one doesn't. Then naively it looks like this picture breaks time reversal, but secretly it's not, turns out. All right, so now let me talk about this. This story. So the dualities I mentioned before, they're all one component field theories, one Dirac fermion or one Wilson-Fisher boson. Also on one side, at least on one side of the duality, we understand the theory pretty well. Free Dirac fermion, we understand everything. Wilson-Fisher boson, we almost understand everything. So you say, okay, the duality per se, we understand. We don't gain that much. But here's a duality that we understand the theory on neither side, actually, fully. So the left-hand side, I have two Wilson-Fisher bosons, Z1 and Z2, again tuned to criticality. But they couple to the same dynamical U1 gauge field, little b. Okay? I'm suppressing coupling to external gauge field because it gets messy. But this is the theory. The claim is that it's dual to this guy. So I have two Dirac fermions, psi 1 and psi 2, and they couple to the same dynamical gauge field, little a. Okay. So this theory is known as CP1 theory. Well, it's more precisely, it's the easy plane version of the CP1. For those of you who know it, the easy plane, because the quadratic term is z1 fourth plus z2 fourth, rather than z1 squared plus z2 squared and square the whole thing. This theory is known as QED3. It's a three-dimensional, or 2+1-dimensional quantum electrodynamics with flavor number 2. Okay? The claim will be the two theories are actually the same. Well, this is quite non-trivial, because for the previous theories, at least on one side, I know at least a non-trivial fixed point exists, so free Dirac or Wilson-Fisher. But here, even that is not completely clear. The exact IR fate of both theories have been controversial for probably more than a decade. So on this side, the issue is whether the transition is continuous. If I tune a boson mass cross zero, on this side, it's the issue is whether at low energy I'll spontaneously develop a fermion mass for this guy, and that's known as the spontaneous chiral symmetry breaking. Whether that happens. It turns out that this duality, in the weakest sense, is saying the two issues are the same issue. Really. But here, let me be optimistic, and let me assume both actually flow to a non-trivial fixed point. And in fact, amazingly, there are some very recent numerical evidence supporting that. Before this thing came out, when we were working on this, we have to apologize constantly to ourselves, saying, "Yeah, let's assume the fixed point exists." But now, okay, we're more confident about that statement now. So
what is that evidence?
So this work, there are several different works. So this work is on the lattice version of the quantum electrodynamics. So it's a lattice gauge theory simulation. So this work, I think Yingchen is a co-author. This work, Yingchen is a co-author on that, and it's simulating a Kagome, actually ferromagnetic transition at the one-third plateau that's believed to be in the easy plane CP1 universality class with some caveats, potentially. And this one did two simulations. This one simulated, they simulated some spin model, something that's equivalent to spin model on the lattice that's believed to be, one of them is believed to be in this universality class. The other one is in this universality class. For this one, they simulated essentially an easy plane JQ model, but the actual detailed term is different from the one that's simulated before. I think they have easy plane J, but Heisenberg Q, or the opposite. All this look like a continuous transition, given the size of their simulation.
What type of data do they look at, like say critical exponent for both, or?
Yeah, you first see if it's obviously a first order transition. There's but that's not seen. Then you can try to do scaling, see if you get good scaling.
Okay.
You get reasonable scaling. You can estimate critical exponents and so on.
And do they have some information about how the IR fixed point is approached? Like, say, how the flow goes towards the IR fixed point?
I'm not sure exactly. I know what you mean.
So
they can measure finite size behavior. That's they have to. Right. And from that, you extract data like scaling dimension and so on.
Right. But the fixed point is not only defined by a set of critical exponents, right? So also the way that you approach to it that matters. So.
Oh, you mean which relevant operator they're tuning?
Right.
Yeah, they know that.
Okay.
Okay. So those are actually pretty cool field theories. But if you're a dead hard condensed matter guy and don't care about field theory per se, here's some reason why we should care about these field theories. So this QED3 with two Dirac fermions is actually a SPT transition. This is shorthand for symmetry protected topological phases. So particular, this is a phase transition describing a transition from a trivial boson insulator to a bosonic version of the integer quantum Hall effect. And so the way you think about this is to imagine turning on a mass term for the Dirac fermions here. And then once the Dirac fermions are gapped, you integrate them out. And this is the response you get for the Dirac fermion. You generate a Chen Simon term at plus minus level 1 for the little a. And this is the pure gauge theory. Then you further integrate out little a. And this is the response you get. So depending on the sign of mass, you either get 0, which is a trivial insulator, or 2, a Chen Simon term at level 2, which is means Hall conductance 2. And it's known that for bosons, for a boson integer quantum Hall state, the minimum Hall conductance is exactly 2. So this indeed describes a transition of that. Okay. And for this CP1, there's an even longer history. It's known to describe, let's call it deconfined quantum phase transitions. So it's a transition of this. So imagine a square lattice anti-ferromagnet. For example, if you put, and I put spin half per site on the lattice. Well, there are two simple symmetry breaking phases, ground states, for this guy. So the most common one is a nail anti-ferromagnet. So I have up-down kind of spin ordering. So this guy breaks the spin rotation symmetry, right? But it keeps the lattice fourfold rotation symmetry, right? If I rotate by 90 degrees around a site, nothing changes, right? But I can also have another symmetry breaking state that's known as the valence bond solid. It's like this. And each solid line here, forget about this picture, but each solid line here represents a singlet, formed by the two spin halves on the link. So that's a ground state. It's obvious that since it's a singular state, the spin rotation symmetry is not broken. It's preserved. But the lattice C4 rotation, the 90 degree rotation, is obviously broken. Right? There's a fourfold degeneracy on this ordering pattern. Oh, if you, let's say I take a site, I rotate by 90 degree, this picture breaks. If I do this, nothing changes. Yeah. Right, so this transition is a transition, it's a direct and potentially continuous transition between two such phases. And if I do conventional Landau-Ginzburg type of theory of phase transition, this is disallowed. Because they break totally different symmetries. So if I do Landau, I either go through a strong first order transition, or I need some intermediate phase to get this. But quantum mechanically, it turns out, it's possible to have a direct and probably even continuous transition. And this CP1 theory is supposed to describe exactly that. So the logic roughly is I turn on a boson mass term. And if the mass is, let's say, negative, this Z's will be gapped, and once this Z's will condense, and once this Z's condense, my little gauge field is Higgs. I don't worry about it. But then this Z1 dagger Z2 is condensed. Right? This is gauge invariant. So and this represents the nail order parameter. This is the I get an antiferromagnet. But with the opposite sign of the mass, the Z bosons are gapped. And this little b becomes a free Maxwell photon. So that's another, if you like, superfluid phase. It turns out they will be further broken down to Z4, and you get the VBS. But that's some high order detail I'm not going to worry about here. The bottom line is this describes this non-Landau transition. Okay. And if I assume the duality, inevitably I'll say, OK, the two transitions are secretly the same transition. This is actually quite, let me also say that the two tuning parameters here, this guy and this guy, do not correspond to each other. They correspond, you know, this guy corresponds to something else in the other theory. So it's quite different. So microscopically, the two transitions are very different. They even have different symmetries and so on. But if I assume the duality, they're the same. And in particular, the exponents should match in some non-trivial way. If I measure the critical exponent, for example, I would the duality will predict many such relations, but one of them is this. So this is new for the deconfined critical transition, and this is the eta for the QED for the chiral fermion mass. Right? You can measure this, for example, in the lattice gauge theory simulation or the lattice spin simulation. Right? And turns out this relation is broadly consistent with what people have found very recently. For example, in these two papers, found that the eta for the fermion chiral mass is about 1. And in these two simulations, the nu for the xy deconfined critical point is about 0.5. And you can do a real-time calculation and see that this is roughly consistent. Cool.
Isn't this new, in a very high accuracy from all this?
None of this is in a very high accuracy. For example, I think.
No, I mean from previous work. So is this new for the easy plane?
Yeah.
But you were describing in the last slide, were you describing an easy plane or an?
Yeah. In this case, okay, this picture works for both, but in this case, I'm focusing on the easy plane. Yeah. Yeah, for the easy plane, this has a much higher, much larger error bar.
These were calculated, like a decade ago, but what people found was there was very strong corrections of scaling at very large length scales, right?
No, for the Heisenberg, for the fully SO3.
For the easy plane case.
For the easy plane, I thought previously people just then you see a first order transition.
No. So the reason people believe that that's first order
right.
is because there's very strong scaling corrections.
Okay.
Which are now also observed in the SU2 invariant case, but
yeah.
at a different length scale. So if there's this question of
the
interpretation of,
yeah.
of basically the corrections of scaling.
Right.
Okay.
what are the tree level values for those exponents?
Oh, tree level, this is about 0.5.
Okay.
This is about, let's say, 3, because it's a fermion bilinear. Yeah.
So the earlier you said the duality in terms of the same sort of universality class, but
yeah.
Now even they don't have the same critical exponents, it's just there's a
No. Yeah. Because, well, actually, the reason is because this guy, in the CP1 theory, which gives it a new, in the operator dictionary of this duality, which I didn't show you, correspond to this guy. So meaning the two operators should have the same scaling dimension. And this is just a way to write that. Yeah. Yeah, OK. All right, so and it turns out there are more dualities on this theory. So it turns out each one of the theory on the two sides have their own self-dual. So self-dual means that this theory is due to this theory, which has the same form of the Lagrangian, but it's not a trivial rewriting of replacing Z by W, because the way symmetries act on these two theories are very different. For example, in this Z theory, what corresponds to the conservation of the spin, the nail vector, which is essentially the difference between the two charges on Z1 and Z2. Turns out on the self-dual side, on the W theory, correspond to the conservation of the magnetic flux of this little b. So essentially, if I go from here to here, I have to exchange my flux symmetry with the current symmetry. And similar things happen, turns out, on the QED side. Again, two theories, same Lagrangian, but totally different symmetry action. Okay, so essentially I have a smaller web. It's not an infinite web, but still a web of four theories mutually dual to each other. So what do I learn out of this? Well, if I assume this duality, then there's an interesting thing happening. Because as I said before, my definition of duality is that I have two field theories. They flow to the same IR fixed point, but they don't have to be the same in the UV. Well, if they don't have to be the same in the UV, then they don't have to have the same symmetry in the UV. Right? My theory 1 can have symmetry G1. My theory 2 can have global symmetry G2. But if they actually flow to the same fixed point, and if there's nothing singular happening along the flow, let's say the symmetry is not spontaneously broken, then necessarily I have to conclude that my IR fixed point has to have a symmetry G that's larger than the two. It has, at least, it has to contain G1 and G2 as subgroups. Okay? That's an inevitable consequence. Okay? If I apply that logic to this mini web of duality, what do I get? Well, for this QED, naturally there's an SU2 flavor symmetry on this guy. It's a quadratic. This action is quadratic in psi. Right? And similarly, I have a SU2 flavor symmetry on the chi. And it turns out the two are completely independent. I'm not going to show you exactly why that's so here, but just take it. And it's obvious that in this easy plane CP1 theory, there cannot be anything like SU2 at the level of Lagrangian. Remember this F(z1) fourth plus Z2 fourth. So there's you cannot have an SU2 rotation between the Z1 and Z2. Even if you do, turns out they must be different from these two SU2s. But there is a discrete Z2 symmetry that exchanges Z1 and Z2. So that's this guy. And it turns out these three symmetries generate the entire total symmetry. From SU2 cross SU2, you get SO4. And it turns out this Z2 acts as an improper reflection on this SO4 space. And then you get O4 symmetry in total. So yeah. Oh, OK. Yeah.
Sorry. How is the Z2 not contained already in the flavor symmetries?
It's not. Well, if you work through the dictionary, you realize that the Z2 acts, the way the Z2 acts is to exchange psi with chi.
Oh, okay.
It's, yeah. That's why this Z2 exchanged the two SU2 and then it accessed the improper rotation. The funny thing about this story is that if I look at each single Lagrangian, I don't see O4 at all. So I have to actually take all the dual theory as the definition of my theory. Only then I realize that, oh, I have an O4 symmetry for the fixed point, if it exists. And let me just very briefly mention that for the case of if I have a full SU2 rotation symmetry in the CP1 theory, so this is really the CP1, properly the CP1 theory, so this quadratic term looks different from what I have before. We've conjectured another duality on this guy. So on the dual side, again, I have QED3, again, 2 Dirac fermions, but the 2 Dirac fermions coupled to a critical Ising scalar, phi, as a mass. Okay. We also call this QED3 Gross-Nouveau theory. And turns out this theory is, but this is actually a more complicated theory, has many interesting features. But what I'm just going to say that both theories, similar to the previous case, have their own self-dual theories, same Lagrangian, different symmetry actions. And if I follow the logic for which I get the O4 emergent symmetry, in this case, I actually get an emergent SO5 symmetry for this case. And this symmetry has actually been numerically observed actually 2 years ago by Adam Nahum and his collaborators. And at that time, it was a mystery. So we had, you know, it was very hard to, there were some suggestive arguments about this SO5 before, but when you actually see that, it's very hard to actually understand why that's the case. But this duality, in some sense, resolves this this mystery.
So the SO5 is spontaneously broken?
No, it's not. At the critical point, it's emergent. So if you tune away from a critical point, it's gone. Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah.
When you say continuous transition or criticality, do you mean like it's described by conformal theory, or it's something we call?
Presumably. I mean, okay, if you are really pedantic, you can say, in 2 plus 1, if it's scaling invariant, and let's assume it's Lorentz invariant, there's no real proof that it must be conformal, but let's assume it's conformal.
Okay, then these critical exponents and so on consistent with any other constant.
Okay, that's the tricky part. That's if you do conformal bootstrap on this kind of thing, you get a totally different story, which we're still trying to understand. So there are some possible scenarios that can resolve it, but we're still trying to understand.
Yeah. Sir, does this, at least the fermionic theory, I think should have a line of fixed points, right? There should be a marginal deformation which corresponds to, I don't know, I think the phi cubed term or something like that.
Is that obvious?
Well, at large end, it certainly is known, but like it's not clear whether it persists.
Yeah, large end I can see, because then the phi has scaling dimension 1, blah, blah, blah. But
right.
Yeah, but here, phi obviously doesn't do
right.
That.
So is there any evidence of anything like that, or do you think it's an isolated point?
I think it's an isolated point.
Just two, can you like wrap up, and then you know questions now, and oh, yeah.
Here we go. Yeah, so I've talked about a web extent of duality extending the well-known boson vortex one duality, and then, yeah, here's a brief application on the deconfined criticality. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yes.
This emergent symmetry is very fascinating.
Thanks.
In the first example of boson vortex duality.
Yeah.
Do you expect any emergent symmetry at the critical point?
In the boson vortex duality, the symmetries on the two sides are exactly identical, even at the UV. You have some U1 charge conservation, you have some time reversal inversion, they all match, right? So then you don't expect just out of that something bigger. Here the thing is at the UV Lagrangian, the two symmetries are obviously different. Then you expect something larger. To emerge in the IR. Yeah.
How will the story change if I break Lorentz symmetry in most of these theories?
Oh.
Expect dualities to be there as well? And
if you turn on the perturbation, if the duality is indeed true, then the perturbation should have the same effect.
Okay.
Right. So, well, exactly what the perturbation does is, okay, that's
a
different question.
They can say you have a model where you have a Fermi surface.
Oh, okay. Right. So, things involving Fermi surface are harder, but sometimes they can be incredibly interesting. For example, if I take this duality, and if I have a Fermi surface on this side, okay, I can do that. That actually corresponds to turning on a big magnetic field on this side. And that actually, you map that to the problem of half-field lambda level. That's exactly how we do think about half-field lambda level in this case. But if I take some random duality out of this web and think about Fermi surface, there are some complicated things. Usually, if you have a Fermi surface, that's the easy side. Whichever side that gives you a Fermi surface, it's the easy side. You can start doing mean field, postulate you have a Fermi liquid, blah, blah, blah. And then the other side looks horribly complicated. So, yeah. Yeah.
So in
Oh, okay.
So if you imply that SO5 symmetry has been seen, what I what model is that?
So that's the loop model that they are simulating. So you map the CP1 model morally to a classical loop model in three dimensions in Euclidean space.
Okay.
Then you do a pretty large size simulation. You still see drifting exponents and so on. But what they did is to essentially plot the histogram of the nail and the VBS order parameter,
mm-hmm.
Look at how they distribute. And what they've seen is that as system size grows larger and larger, the distribution becomes more and more round.
So is that model more close to like kind of discretizing the theory, the field theory, the CP1 theory on a lattice so that the loops are these? Like it's not coming from a microscopic model, like
right,
the
right.
cases you were talking about.
More or less. It's still at strong coupling, but yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, so in 1+1, there's a immersion SO4 which maps like Neo and VBS orders.
Yeah.
Can you understand that as coming from a duality as well?
You probably can. Let me not state an overly strong statement. I haven't tried seriously. The reason that you probably don't need to do that there is because you have the Y-Zimino model, which is renormalizable in 1+1 for that critical point. Here you can also do a Y-Zimino for the SO5, but it becomes non-renormalizable, then becomes trickier to define what that even means. But in 1+1, you have more ways to deal with that. But I haven't thought very carefully about whether you can do it with duality.
Okay, so that's the last question for Peter.
Okay. So you have this web of dualities that allow you to predict or explain that the theory and the IR will have more symmetry than individual theory.
Yeah.
Can you use that to try to now go back to the original microscopic or UV theories and try to enlarge the symmetry, modify the microscopic description so that emergent symmetry is realized microscopically?
Yeah, okay. So the two answers to that. The first one is morally you can. It's going to be a strongly coupled microscopic theory for sure. It's not going to be a renormalizable field theory, but in principle you can. This guy did. When these guys were simulating the QED, it's not really QED. It's a lattice model that we believe it falls to the QED. The microscopic symmetry actually has SO4. It's much larger than just the bare QED. So in some sense, they're already doing that. That's one answer. But the other answer is, for this guy, they can do SO4 on the lattice, but not O4. The reason is the full O4 is actually anomalous symmetry, which you are not allowed to realize on the lattice. So to your answer is, as long as it's not anomalous, you can try to do it. And the SO5 is also anomalous, so you cannot do the full SO5.
SO5 is anomalous?
See in this
your example?
Yeah. So also is the O4.
So can you detect that in some way? That means that...
Yeah, in fact, on the lattice, we understand exactly why that's so, that's anomalous. So this is an emergent symmetry, right? It's a continuous. But on the lattice, what you have is some C4 rotation and spin rotation, which is SO3. So this anomaly is characterized, well, physically by the fact that, okay, this may get a little bit technical, but if I insert a monopole, an instanton, that instanton actually carries some spin half degree of freedom. That's it, precisely why it's anomalous. And on the lattice, we know exactly what that means, because that monopole corresponds to a defect of the VBS order. And if you literally draw a picture of the defect, you realize there's a dangling spin site that's not paired to anything. So that's a spin half there. So yeah, it actually pictures match.
Okay, so let's thank John again. And he will be here till tomorrow.
I'm heading out tomorrow morning, okay, 11.
So
yeah.
Basically, the rest of the day here,
yeah.
I'm going to talk to him. He's around. Thank you.
Thanks.